Okay. So today we're going to have a directed discussion on.
Allowing for loops or not?
Oh, what?
Allowing for loops.
Yeah.
That's the word. The word directed beggars the belief of credibility.
There's this idea that we had one of the talks by, I guess it was Paul Hayes who actually started this all, where he was talking about the diffusion question, and it was a question of where 1 over n comes from in the expression. So we thought that it would be good to have a bit of a deeper understanding of the way that evolution is modeled in terms of both neutral evolution, selection, Boydian recombination, all these things. So it's Luca and David are going to be leading the discussion.
Okay, yeah, so what I was going to do here is maybe just try to give a really brief, really fast overview of some basic components, just in case that there's some people who aren't overly familiar with them. And again, this is all sort of off my top of my head after a decade out of graduate school without any text here. So, you know, anybody, absolutely the point of this is directed discussion. Feel free to rip in and say I'm wrong or discuss anything. But I was going to try to make this a real quick thing. And then Luca's going to launch into some nice review of the mathematics behind the neutral theory and basically summarizing a lot of Kimura's work. And then afterwards, if we have time and still the inclination, I have a bunch of topics prepared just to lead discussion on in terms of modern ways of looking at neutralism and selectionism and adaptation and trying to measure that with real data and the kinds of data we get. Thought we'd have a free-for-all. I realized I just realized about half an hour ago that the next 3 weeks are all devoted to population genetics and a number of people who are doing some real great work on it. So I just view this as rather than I'm not trying to do any kind of thorough overview, but just opening up the discussion, maybe perhaps bringing in a lot of the terms that those people in the next 3 weeks are going to be using and arguing about them, and then that hopefully everybody will be better prepared to listen to some great work over the next 3 weeks. Like people like Oda, for example, who's she's been at the core of this, and just you should listen to her. Oda and Gillespie, or I'm having Oda and Gillespie coming here in terms of fit adaptation and neutralism and things. It's just fantastic. So here I just have, I try to get, the most intense things to the real basics, but just to remind everybody what is the basic Darwinian paradigm that's sort of behind everything, which basically said variation happens. If there's differential fitness, then that leads to selection, i.e., in modern recent interpretation, you'd have changes in frequency of genes, and that leads to fixation of certain genes, survival of the fittest, and all that. There's a number of words that are associated with these things that all have a little bit of fuzzy meaning, or sometimes need to be defined a little bit better. Particularly, people talk about fitness and selection and adaptation, and particularly the last word, adaptation, can be subject to a lot of variable interpretation. So the simplest thing, and Luca will be using these terms in his discussion, so it's good to just have these in mind real quick, is that we talk about fitness W, and that has real meaning in terms of relative. That is, I look at two individuals or two alleles in the population, and I say the probability of survival is different in that population. Right, so they have a relative fitness, relative probability of survival. So for example, if I say the fitness of allele I is 1, right, and then the fitness of allele J is 1 minus S, right, that's different fitness, and then S is the selective coefficient. Okay, so this would be negative selection against allele G, J relative to
They look at, how do they measure it? Do they look at the rate, the logarithm? Is it the absolute sort of a population size after some time, or do you take the logarithm, or what
do you think? It's the ratio of progeny in the next generation.
Oh, right. Per generation. It's defined as per generation.
After Luca talks, I'd like to more open up and talk about how we measure these things. But so far, this is just sort of, here I'm trying to give the basics of the definitions and the and the things. But one thing I wanted to make clear in terms of this, though, is that, you know, you talk about absolute fitness, and you have to question whether absolute fitness makes necessarily a lot of sense. Because if you're thinking about absolute fitness, you're thinking about a whole population, and you may be thinking that means in terms of whether a population is growing or shrinking, right? But in fact, like, for example, with a population, whether it's absolutely fit over the long term is really a question, and this is the question you'd be asking conservation genetics, what's the probability that it ever reaches the absorbing state, that is extinction, right? And then it's all over. And that's sort of the fitness of the population. It doesn't really, just because the population size is big or small, in the long run doesn't necessarily mean it's actually more fit in an abstract sense. And I'm really just trying to say that you need to divorce fitness in terms of competing alleles from fitness in terms of the population. So in case anybody's making that linkage, they should sort of erase that linkage in their minds. Other important things to consider here are ploidy, okay, by which we mean the number of copies of the genome in an individual at a particular time, right? So you have haploid, you're just assuming there's one copy of everything. Diploid, you're assuming there's two copies of everything. In fact, there's just about every kind of ploidy system out there you can imagine in real plants and animals, haploid, diploid. Organisms spend different amounts of time in the haploid state, the diploid state. Generally, in most models you'll be looking at, they're just going to ignore all that, but sometimes not. Sex, which is always fun in population genetics, like to put sex in the title of every paper they can possibly get it in, just so it gets more attention. But you actually have to start asking yourself what you mean by sex. And a lot of people have focused in particular on the advantages and disadvantages of sex. And what's usually sometimes meant by that is you have the segregation into the male and the female. Right, there's a number of components to what we consider a sexual system, as in humans. Right, we've got males and females, we've got the ploidy, and we've got recombination, and they're all involved in the process of sex and trying to get out the components of that. But the principal thing about the cost of sex is that you've got two full cups of sex. That is, if you're putting energy into individuals, if half of them are males, they're basically a waste of resources. Right, relative to the females that can reproduce. So if you suddenly start producing all females, you can suddenly have a reproductive rate that's twice as much, and then you should outcompete the normally sexually reproducing. So then there's a bunch of questions about, well, then why isn't everybody female? Why do we need these useless males? And since there's been a lot of males in population genetics, they spend a lot of time trying to justify. So far, I should add, generally, a complete failure. not complete failure. There's certainly not a complete explanation for males, let's put it that way. Then there's recombination, and I'm not going to talk about that a lot, but just to put in that it's an extremely important component. And normally, like what I think most of what Luca's going to be talking about would still go in the category of what we might call beanbag genetics, which was originally a kind of disparaging term, but I think it's sort of fun, you know, which is basically everything's being viewed as a big bag full of genes, right? And they're different colors of genes, right? So just sort of, you know, we're looking at a big bag full of colors of jelly beans. And we're talking about a system where there's just this bag is a constant size, right? And we just empty out the jelly bean every generation, and then pick jelly beans for the next generation. And then we look at the process, you know, we add selection in there on different alleles. But it's just this process of regenerating this bag of jelly beans, essentially. And there's a whole bunch of assumptions inherent in that in the basic model. So we're talking about random mixing, right? We're talking about the population size is completely constant, for one. And that leads to one particularly important distinction that everybody really needs to have in their mind when they're listening to anything about that is the difference between the population size and the effective population size. So in a general way, when we talk about the effective population size, what we're talking about is that population size which would have the properties of a population which was a population, a constant population which was randomly mixing, were it to be that size. Okay, so that means, for example, I mean, this came up in Walter's talk the other day, but there's a bunch of things that affect the effective population size. So for example, if the population size is fluctuating wildly across generations, right, is that the properties of the long-term population are going to tend to take on the properties of the smaller, the smallest populations in that fluctuating range. Right, so that means you're going to tend to have a real decrease in the effective population size compared to the, say, the average population size that you observe at any one time. Is that roughly speaking clear? So then the other important thing,
is this effective size something it's measurable?
It's something that some people love and some people hate with a passion. Okay, because it doesn't mean anything. It's not a real entity, the effective population size. And in fact, it does depend on how you measure it. It depends strongly on how you measure it. So usually you're measuring something that you're saying, if there was an effective population size of X, we'd have these consequences. You look at the data, these are the consequences we see, you infer the effective population size. But it doesn't really mean anything, and it changes depending on how you measure it, and it changes with a whole bunch of factors.
So is it any
good? Yeah.
I think it might be useful to take an example, and you brought up the population size variability.
Yeah.
One over N sub E is equal to the average of the sum of the population sizes over different generations. Some 1 over n for however many populations. And what you end up getting is a population size which is not the true population size.
That's the category.
And what you end up having is the size of population would have to be to have the same kinetics as the population over time is you're seeing with the 1 over n's. That is, if the population size were held constant at NE and it was all random, then that would give you the same effect as what is really going on with different blocks. So you can take the different population sizes and get the effective size out of it. And there are other things like differential mating gives you the same thing, the same kind of problem. If a few males get all the females, then...
I was going to bring that up. It's very important. Differential reproductive success.
So anyway.
Isn't it simply the population that contributes the fraction of the population, of the number of individuals that contribute actually to the next generation?
No. Much smaller than that.
Well, but that's different from the total population, because not the total population might contribute to the next generation.
Yeah, but it's even different. Say, even the population size is even different from the number of individuals.
Right, so what you're talking about, if you said that, and you said there's some fraction that contributes to the next generation, that should go into your NI right there. But then it's still these effects.
So it's some trick to match a random time homogeneous model.
Exactly like activities versus concentration in chemistry.
Another effect is like assortative mating, where people of the same ethnic group tend to marry within the group rather than outside, or tall people choose tall people to marry, or and that sort of thing. Or sort of mating can also be the other way around, that you're looking for differences and that tends to inflate NE. Almost everything else, NE is less than the population size.
That's the easiest thing to say, is almost any deviation.
The only process that I know of that causes NE to be inflated rather than deflated relative to population is negative assorted as rating, where the you're choosing things that are unlike to mate with rather than things that are alike.
Yeah, yeah, like incestuary or something like that.
Not incestuary. That's slightly different, but.
So that means for small population, negative assorted typically is actually a good idea, is that not?
It depends what you're trying to maximize. I mean, if you're a conservation biologist and you're trying to maximize the continuation of genetic variability, that's exactly what they do. But whether that's ever something that's been long-term selected for a population. I mean, humans positively assertively mate. I mean, if you just look around at your average assemblage of couples, you know, in a mixed population, you'll probably see that visually, right?
Inbreeding is another basis by which envy gets down, which is what you were talking about, mating with your nephews.
Which tends to lower any.
Tends to lower any.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Well, which means males will go to fixation faster, yeah. As fast as if they were that smaller size, even though the population.
Well, I'm just wondering, is it have people observed an E larger than
F? I don't know about that.
There's an interesting graph in one of May's books, which is, Walter, maybe you can help me reconstruct this. This is N versus heterozygosity, which is roughly speaking the variability of alleles in a population. And I think you basically get predictions of sort of sigmoidal curves like that, where this would be a completely neutral model and this would be a model of selection. And the data you know that what I'm talking about?
No, I don't know.
So I mean, this is a rough. And I mean, I learned again later too that when after he gives you the Kimura stuff, the sort of modern interpretations of there's actually a lot of good reasons why this should be so. And some of this comes back to you actually also have one of the most important developments recently has been work initiated by Charlesworth and Hudson and then a bunch of other people. But actually, you have any particular locus is going to experience a local effective population size, which has to do with the amount of recombination that's happening around it and the amount of selective effects at surrounding sites, right? Whether they're selective sweeps which are occurring at surrounding sites or the nearly neutral model that Ota came up with quite some time ago. Those sorts of things sort of can reduce the effect of local population size. So there's a bunch of interesting stuff that's coming out of that. I want to try to wrap this up real quickly because I want to hand off to Luca pretty quickly. But I wrote dominance there, but I mean, in a diploid system, you have the question of whether a particular loci are dominant to each other, right? So you have recessiveness and dominance and over-dominance. That is whether you have a balanced polymorphism. I can go into that if anybody's wants me to, but okay, so I'm just going to skip. I'm going to sort of assume that you know what I'm talking about there. But another point I wanted to bring in just quickly is that we tend to think about selection in terms of survival, right? That's as Walter was saying, whether you know there's a certain population that survives to make it to reproduction, but in fact there's huge effects. So there's not just survival, but whether you are fecund, that is, for female, whether they're capable of reproducing actually at the point when they try to reproduce. And there's fertility, that is, if you're in a couple, whether the couple itself is capable of reproducing. And those kinds of effects have dramatically different sort of dynamic consequences in terms of genes. And importantly, too, what it means is that when you think of selection and the amount of, maybe you think about genetic load and the amount of selection that a population is capable of, right? I mean, if you look at humans, you could think, oh, you know, most humans survive. There's not that much room for selection in modern humans. but there's still room for a lot of selection in terms of fertility and fecundity. Okay, so it's really not, I mean, even with humans, you probably couldn't say that there's no selection going on. And people have tried to measure this, in fact, and I think the numbers are, it's hard to estimate, but Walter Krickman from Vermont, around a third is probably just selection for survival, to reproductive age.
I don't think it's very well known as wild death.
Yeah.
There's so much loss, say, of fetuses and so forth that just aren't observed. And so that the total amount of deaths that are occurring aren't known. And so you divide it up into groups. Some of the groups you don't know what the size is. Right?
Yeah, so some people basically have made wild guesses of around a third. There's at least a strong belief that there's a lot of selection going over a large proportion, maybe 50%, maybe two-thirds, maybe nine-tenths, you know, with it so better, is due to fertility and fecundity rather than just selection for survival. But yeah, as Walter says, they're educated wild guesses. They're sort of like we were talking about the other day, Carl Sagan coming up with, you know, the number of important differences between chimps and humans being 64. Anyway, you get the idea though that you just want to go to the main point for tracking. You don't want to just assume that survival is the only thing that's important. And there's a lot of people who have done a lot of really nice work of looking at the differences of the dynamics between these different kinds of systems, and they get extremely complicated, beautiful mathematics. I mean, if you just want to see some fun mathematics and fun, if you like dynamical systems, there's a bunch of beautiful dynamic systems, and particularly when you talk about two locus models and things like that.
Do you find the term genetic mode?
So genetic mode, I mean, if you're having, so there's only so much select, I mean, if you just view this in terms of survival, right, every generation there's only so much, there's so many allele, or so many people that can die. You know, so many organisms that can, you know, percentage selection, that is, this number die and this number survive in a real situation. So you can count, I mean, if you say that there's selective effects, right, I mean, if you do sort of the beanbag genetics and you just look at, you know, you count, treat them as though they're separate, right, I mean, that's part of the problem with beanbag genetics, is you're just treating these things in isolation. Right, you're saying if this were an isolated thing, it's only selective effect, what would be going on? Right, but if you add that up, basically if you say that there's, you know, 10 million alleles and they all have selective coefficients of, you know, 0.5, that doesn't make sense, right, in terms of there's just not enough selection going on to have that many loci that can be selected to that.
One way of looking at it is that you can't get, supposing you've got a new mutation and it's favored, its fitness is greater than all the others, then it's going to take some generations to go to fixation. And the question, you can ask the question, how many of the unfavored type are going to be killed off in order for this favored gene to have spread and be fixed in the population? And that'll be a number that can be quite large, and that's called the genetic load, is my view.
Why should individuals need to be killed off? I mean, isn't it just a differential thing of the number of offspring? I don't understand.
Yeah, but you can't have, the point is you can't have differential probabilities of survival on too many genes. You know, I mean, basically if you viewed that as like, you know, if it was all, I mean, you're assuming additivity, right? And you're assuming everything's additive, and if you assume all that, and they're like, yeah, it'd be something like this, right? Now, if you assume that you have a certain frequency of alleles in a population that are like that, that is a frequency of J versus I, right, and you do it across a bunch of different genes, then the total amount of selection going up has to add up to the amount of individuals that die.
But it's never going to be additive. I mean, I would say if I have some mutation that brings my average number of children from 2 to 2.1, that's fine. But I mean, if I have 10 of those guys, I'm not going to have on average 8.4 children or something like that. So I mean, this is why would people
assume that? No, but that's the main generation, the population which is 2.1, we win.
Yes, but But it's always going to be in a range between, say, 2 and 3 or something like that, however many loci I look at. So I.
Okay. Another thing is this selection coefficient, that all context dependent, right? Will depend on the environment. So in some environment, this gene could be useless. It doesn't matter what you
constant. So what we're talking about, there are a lot more that is, in fact, we do have a belief that reality is not being back genetics. Right, and that's sort of what we're talking about. There's different environments, and things might be selected in one generation or another. There can be, in fact, multiplicative effects. So one individual, right, I mean, it may be that you have enough, part of the randomness of the selective effects is like, you're worse off. Right, you have a lower probability, and part of it is the maximum probability. So if you accumulate enough bad alleles, bam, you're dead. That can be part of it. It's like just random chance. So there's a lot of.
Anyway, this term genetic law, I just heard it several times, but I've heard it a number of times.
I think the definition of what they call a mutational load, right? Which is how much is the fitness of the population reduced due to the occurrence of deleterious mutations. So if you say the best one is a fitness one, okay, and there are lots of these alleles with fitnesses one minus little s there, and there's recurrent mutation making these unfavorable alleles all the time, which are going to be mostly eliminated by selection, but nevertheless there's going to be some fraction of deleterious mutations in the population all the time. So if you measure the average fitness of the population and you ask how far below the maximum possible one is it, then that's what we call mutational load. I think
he's. So if it goes below zero, then you're.
It was different from the cost.
But what you talked about was the substitutional load. That means the effort, say, in reproduction investment that is necessary to carry on the substitution of advantages.
So now we have substitutional load, genetic load,
and they
mutational load, to say that you have reached some sort of equilibrium, you have the fitness maximum for a given gene, and then you have a bunch of mutations which arise, and then you have the effect, the average fitness of the population is reduced with respect to the maximum because of the presence of these mutating alleles, which are always reproduced within the population, because of that. And then there is the other mechanism, is really the waste that the population undergoes, because when an advantageous mutant arises, before it gets fixed in the population, you have a competition between an advantageous mutant and all the rest, which are lower fitness. And you can ask, what would have been the average fitness if the mutant had already been established immediately, say when it arrived. And so there is a difference in that, and that is called the substitutional law.
So in the second, you're not talking about the stationary state.
No, it's just because of the substitution.
Okay, but it's the same thing, it's just a transient version of
integrated version of that, and then until you reach fixation.
One interesting thing that either is going to help or make things confusing is that if you ignore recombination, there's no recombination going on, you can calculate a point which will reach what's called mutational meltdown. Okay, and that's the fact that as you're getting negative substitutions, right, or deleterious substitutions, not deleterious substitutions, what's going to happen at some point is you can't select those out of the population fast enough. Okay, so that eventually every individual in the population has at least one negative deleterious substitution. That is, there's no perfect individual. Okay, and so then that's the new referent point, and you can see that process will continue such to the point that you're just accumulating more and more deleterious substitutions, and it's called meltdown because you just approach.
Is that just the error threshold?
No, it's Muller's
expression.
It's related to the fact that you have a finite population. Say, given a finite population, then you have a finite probability that the best adapted of your genotypes is lost just by sampling.
Which is probably true. I mean,
and in that case, say, what ends up is that if the probability that you recover that by back mutations is small, then you're left with a population in which there is no representative of the best genotype, and so the current best genotype is less than a theoretical optimum. And then the process repeats again. There is no reason why it stops, so it progresses if you go down. And this is due to the fact that populations is finite.
Is this a theoretical effect, or is it an observed phenomenon?
There is much debate on that.
I mean, the thing is, it's also, you're not going to, there is much debate, but you're not going to observe it as a phenomenon, because if it was a phenomenon, if it's a real phenomenon, and it has to do with genome size, right? So it has to do with, you're going to be at reach that threshold when you increase your functional genome size to the point that you're accumulating negative substitutions. So one of the arguments is that in order, force axis, in fact, recombination allows you to regenerate the optimal phenotype, right? And therefore, you can have a bigger functional genome with recombination.
So in other words, meltdown happens when your genotype is too small.
No, when your genotype is too big and you don't have sex or recombination around it.
I didn't understand. Are we happy with this? Because I don't need to go back to something. I didn't understand the difference between absolute fitness and relative fitness. Because it seems your complaint about absolute fitness that you don't care about anything else, you don't care about population, right? You don't care about whether you go extinct or not, is also true of genes, also. Know that the only thing we care about is whether you are become fixed or eliminated. And so it seems like your objections to absolute fitness are also true about relative fitness as well.
There's not a direct, I think that sometimes people will talk about absolute, you can do these WIDs and you can talk about fitness of populations. Right, but I mean, when you start to think about what constitutes fitness of a population over the long term, they're not a mixing. I mean, populations are not mixing together. Right, so I mean, these genes, you're assuming this beanbag, right? And you're pulling them out, and they're all mixed together. So that when you have different populations, and you're talking about competing populations, you're talking about competing beanbags. Right, you're not talking about competing looks like within the bean bags, and you get, I just don't think it's reasonable when you're talking about fitness on that level, you're really starting to get into ecology, and you're talking about niche partition and a bunch of other things that we're basically ignoring. And I guess my point would really be, when we're talking about this, we are talking about ecology more, and we're talking about a lot of other things that the beanbag geneticist is basically ignoring.
I guess one can say in some of these co-evolution models, it's just an attempt to disentangle those factors that sort of go over the affect the absolute population size, which is maybe somehow widely fluctuating, and maybe the more constant in time relative thing. So you can think of this as a sort of common denominator that's not very well defined, and yet sort of the relative fitness.
Say the absolute fitness, say if you were to, you cannot measure, you are measuring the fitness, say, of a given trait. So you have a population, you classify the individuals which have at least given trait, and then you evaluate the number of, say, fertile offsprings of individuals having that trait. Now, if the population at large is more or less of constant size, the only thing you get on is a ratio between the two number of offsprings. What you can do, say, for instance, when people say measure fitness in bacteria, they take one, say, take a small bunch of bacteria with a given trait, and then put in a brand new petri dish, and then they see how fast the colony increases. Of course, in this way, you have a measure of, say, the colonization speed of this colony, which is a sort of measure of the fitness. But of course, this is completely different from what you can do in the wild for any natural population, which is more or less at equilibrium. And then, if it is not at equilibrium, then you know that you have to take into account ecology and changes in environment and so on.
It seems arbitrary, though, because...
What you're talking about in this situation is a complete overlap of resource, utility, and use. That is, there's a set of resources, and you're just assuming that they're all competing for these exact resources. And so, in fact, when there's a complete overlap of resource use, right, you can say that in ecology, that one population or the other will survive in the end. That is, that one will go extinct and the other won't. But that's the only situation where that matches, where it matches the situation within a population. Right? We're assuming, in this context, we're assuming that these things are going up and down. That is, that we're assuming a completely homogeneous resource, essentially, and the fitness. There's no variability in resource and partitioning. In fact, you could actually go extend that to within a population and say there's different resources. Fit allele I is that has a better fitness in environment, X versus environment Y, and then you get some weird different dynamics. And we're ignoring all of that. And generally, in ecology and actually comparing fitnesses of populations, we just expect a lot of structure like that, and you just gotta think about it.
Yeah, it seems like bacteria, where you're not having sexual reproduction, is sort of an in-between situation, where you could treat the, if there's two different genes, two different forms out of bacteria, and now they are essentially separate species, ignoring genetic transfer.
We have a number of mechanisms that, given the composition of the population at some generation, say, affecting the production of the population at the next generation, and these mechanisms are, say, can be classified roughly as a negative selection, positive selection, and genetic drift. So negative selection is always at work also at the microscopic level, is the fact that whichever traits are non-viable, are definitely worse than the most common traits of the population, they are weeded out. And this is quite effective mechanism for eliminating, say, bad mutants. So this is, on the other hand, with positive selection is the mechanism by which if you have genotypes which confer some sort of advantage with respect to the other ones which are present in the population, they have a tendency of becoming fixed in the population. And this is what, is in the back of our mind every time we talk about adaptation, say, a sort of a drive towards fitter and fitter genotypes, and fitter and therefore fitter and fitter traits. There is a third mechanism, which is genetic drift. The expression is a bit unfortunate because we would like to call it rather diffusion. In fact, Kimura calls it a random drift, to stress the fact that it is a problem. It is a mechanism which is related to fluctuations and not, it's not a directional. Genetic drift is due to the fact that the population's size is finite, and when you go from generation to generation, you are sampling the genotypes at random, and some of the genotypes simply will not be represented in the next population because they had by chance. They were not sampled in this. Now, what happened is that when the first molecular data were available in the late 60s, it appeared that in fact the population populations were extremely variable at the molecular level, which was something that it is not so evident at the phenotypic level. And I will go back to this transparency later, but say, out of the variability, you can have, you can infer what is the rate in which new mutants can be fixed in the population, and you find out that, so this is called the substitution rate, and the and out of the substitution rate, you get, say, information about the rate at which mutation arise, and because the mutation rate is much larger than people thought before, and therefore there is a very large substitutional load, which is, yeah.
Do you mean very specifically a substitution rate or mutation rate?
Mutation rate is the rate in which mutants arise in the population. And substitution rate is the rate at which the mutants get fixed in the population. That means that after a mutant gets fixed, then all the descendants will have one, let's say, will be descendants of an ancestor carrying that mutation. Okay, so I will discuss about that. And the fact is that because of you have this larger mutation rate, then the mutational load and the substitutional load are much larger than expected. And this can only be, say, acceptable in principle if fitness variations is very small. But if fitness variations are most of the time small, this doesn't rule out the fact that there is great negative selection always going on, leading out, say, really the deleterious mutation. It doesn't rule out the fact that there is some positive selection going on, but it tells you that a great deal of the mutations are in fact neutral and they get fixed by genetic reform. That's the gist of Kimura's argument. Now, what I'm going to do is try to put this in a sort of mathematical language, and then I just want to say that this is, of course, a matter of debate and it's gone on for.
I think it's useful to make it very clear that the mutation rate is the property of an individual genome. The substitution rate is a property of the population.
But just to clarify, this term genetic drift stand always only for finite size effects, or could one speak also about diffusion in a large population without?
No, the genetic drift arises from the fact that the population is a finite size.
Fisher's equations are generally assuming an infinite size population, and they basically beat that to death before Kimura came along.
Okay, so this is a cartoon of what genetic drift is about. It's very simple. It's a fact. Imagine that you have two alleles for one gene. I will speak only at the level of beam bank genetics and only of a single gene. So I want to discuss interaction between different loci. So we have black and white allele for one gene, and then say at the beginning we have 50% of each in a population, then generation zero, these are the possible this expansion. Then out of this we select the population for the first generation, and there will be a different proportion just out of sampling. So you go from 50% to 60%, so on. And then you have all these fluctuations, and if you go and simulate, you will have something like that. Start from 50%, and then this is, I don't remember how much, this is 1,000. Population of 1,000 individuals, start from 50%, run it for about 1,000 generations. That's time scale at this level is number of generations on the order of the number of individuals in the population. And what you see is that most of the time you end up that either one or the other allele is fixed. And only from time to time you end up say, with coexistence of two alleles. So what you have is that the genetic drift is a drive towards fixation of alleles in population. And it reduces the variability of the population. Now, this effect is so strong that in some cases it runs counter to the selection factors. So here I have a smaller population, and I have a selection, say, one of the two alleles is preferred by a selection factor, which is, say, order of, I chose it to be of the order of one over the number of individuals in the population here. So in this case, we see that we get always the fixation of the preferred allele. So it's upstairs. But if we look at the bottom, we see that in some cases, we get a fixation of the deleterious allele, just because sampling overcomes the effect of selection. And so the problem is, when does it work and how?
Luca?
Yeah.
All of these things, it's crucial you keep the same population size as a function of time. So how should one think about it in practice? What is doing this thing that keeps the population the same?
Well,
are you just sampling from, are you always sampling 1,000 from?
Yeah, I'm saying the populations do their own sampling. They colonize some area, geographic area, and this geographic area more or less can support a population of a given size. So if you take different generations, the size of the population will not fluctuate that much.
But that already is a selection acting.
And
that's a result of the selection.
Yeah, but this is that means that out of the all possible, germline, all possible DNAs that you can have, You will be whatever is, and you have the population itself is a sample of distribution of these genotypes.
And if it's not constant, you introduce an effective population size.
If it is not constant, so this is just because of
it. It's completely unrealistic. I mean, we know that things are not behave exactly this way. I mean, you don't have sampling with replacement, exactly 100, next generation's exactly 100. But the question being asked is, I mean, it's basic reductionism. If we ignore everything else, we understand something based on that.
But there's also a point, because mathematically, once you always deal with the fixed population size you need, and then you immediately go into Fokker-Planck kind of language of conserved probability and all that, whereas in the science kind of a thing, you really especially killing things and avoiding things, which is
this is the first approximation. If you have, for instance, if you have a population which grows very fast, then what you end up is that you introduce an effective population size, which is not the actual census size of the population, but is really much closer to the founder size of the population. So that you have a much larger population with a smaller variability.
I think if the population was varying, let's say, between two values, the mathematics would be more difficult.
The effective population size would be much smaller, and this is what we usually observe. And we see there are many effects which are reduced. And say, just to go to the basic mathematics, of course, if you have a population which is large but not infinite, then the sampling will be, the frequency, sample frequencies of genes will be close to their actual frequencies, plus, say, a small random term, which will look like a diffusion term. So what you can do is write down an equation for the conditional probability that given, say, at the generation T0, you have a frequency X0 of some allele, then you, at generation T, which is later, you find frequency X. And this will look like a diffusion equation, which will have two terms. This term, the biologists call drift, but of course it's a diffusion term that comes out of the random sampling. And this systematic term here corresponds to the actual effects of selection, of fitness differences. So
what's NA of T? What's NA, little NA?
Okay, X is the fraction of allele A in the population. So it's the number of individuals which allele A.
We're talking about how many, two alleles or many?
In this case, we have two alleles. So we have NA over the total size of the population.
Which may depend on time.
Yeah, but say I'm writing everything in the situation, in fact, in which N does not change with time. But here, say this equation can be written as it is, even if N changes in time. The diffusion term you can evaluate by saying that if I take an increment delta T in time, generation would be 1. Then this D times delta T, this is the D which appears here, is equal to 1/2 the variance of the change in the frequency of the allele with respect to the sampling. And this is, and on the other hand, V, the systematic part, times delta T will be equal to the average value of the change in frequency. So this is very, very useful because it's very easy to estimate these things, even in relatively complicated cases. One has to add the fact that fixation, so if x equals 0 and x equals 1 are special cases, and in this case you have an outflow, and this outflow can be obtained, say, you just look at what is the flow probability either towards 0 or to 1. And you have these two equations which tell you what is the increment of a fixation probability of allele A or the other one. Now, this is a forward diffusion equation which tells you what is the evolution of the probability distribution. And what you can have in mind is that if I have several populations of the same size, and I look at what happens to them along in time, then I will have a distribution of frequencies which obeys this sort of equation. So you just imagine an ensemble population in this way. But we can also look at the reverse, say that if we are given the frequency of our allele at a given time, what was the distribution of the initial frequency? This satisfies a backward differential equation, the backward diffusion equation. So the one thing is that the diffusion term now acts directly on P, and there is change of sign here, and it acts again. And this is quite interesting because if we want to evaluate the probability of fixation, then what we want to know is what is the probability of, say, the distribution probability of x0 given that at any given time x is equal to 1. This is essentially the. So the probability of fixation is given by this expression. And if we want to know what is the probability of ultimate probability of fixation, that is for time going to infinity, then you just plug it in and you get a very simple ordinary differential equation with boundary conditions, of course, that this fixation probability vanishes when the initial probability is 0 and is equal to 1 when the initial probability is equal to 1. Okay, so now just take a finite population. You evaluate if there is no selection at work. I just take a diploid population of size n, so that means the only thing from which I introduce that is to make easier for comparing with the papers. But it only means that we have two n genes 2n individuals instead of less than 9. And so the average variation of the frequency is equal to 0, and the variance is given by this expression. So we obtain this diffusion equation, and of course there is an initial condition which is a Dirac delta. And what is even more simple is what is the equation for fixation probability, which is this one, and of course this means that phi is a linear function of x0 with boundary condition that says that the probability of fixation is equal to the initial probability, which is very simple and very nice.
Initial frequency.
Initial frequency, sorry.
Okay, this you can understand. Okay, maybe
you
can understand it very easily by just looking at the ancestors.
Yeah.
Because okay, the ancestors, you see, all the population has a single ancestor. Go far back in the time.
Yeah.
This is without selection.
Yeah. This is without selection. I just want to show two things. This is the evolution of the distance probability, the frequency distribution, starting from 50%. So, and these are curves for time. The time are evaluated, okay, in number of generations is, the t is the number of generations, and this is in population size divided by 10, by 5, and so on. What you have is that you start, of course, with a delta function, say at t equals 0, and then it sort of goes down and becomes flatter and flatter. By the time in which you are at 2n, which is the number of genes which are present in the population, it is completely flat, and it goes down with a speed which is, it goes down like t or 2.
Wait, I don't understand. What is the y-axis here?
This is the probability of observing this. This is the frequency, and this is the corresponding probability distribution. And of course, you have two peaks here, which are increasing in time, which correspond to fixation. Oh, so okay, that the area goes down as time goes on. And you have this very flat distribution. This is it's clear why it is flat, because most of the time, if you are, say, a bit on the left or you are a bit on the right, you will reach fixation, and you are sort of expanding around. So you are expanding around the top of the curve. Now, here you see that when t is equal to 2n, you have already this flat asymptotic shape. But if you start with a probability which is not close to the middle, then it takes much longer to get to the flat. So even at t2n, you still have the trend, and then you have to wait until t equal 4n to have the flat factor here. But the asymptotic behavior is exactly the same.
But wait, it's a problem with the clocks.
Okay, I just want to mention what happens if you generalize this to multiple alleles, and what you get is that the probability again becomes flat in the sense that it doesn't. You have say n small n alleles. We assume that small n is much smaller than the population size, and you ask what is the probability distribution of having these frequencies. Of course, non-zero and non-one frequencies. And what you get is that this probability is, again, very flat. It doesn't depend asymptotically on these x's if t is large enough. And goes down as e to the minus k times k minus 1 times t divided 4n, where, so k is the number of alleles which are still present in the population. N is, of course, population size. So you get that the states in which more alleles are present decrease more rapidly. And this is probably way of considering that is very by using this reasoning that we can relate that to what is the probability that if I pick up an individual for one allele and an individual for the second allele and so on, what is the probability that I can in fact get there having independent lineages over T generations. So we can evaluate the probability that K gene lineages remain independent over T generations, defined this as I, K, or T. And this obeys this equation. I, K, or T, or T plus 1 is equal, of course, this probability needs to be, is equal to the probability that over T generations they have become independent, times the probability that in going from T generation to T plus 1 generations, parents are all different. And this will be given by this product, 1 over 1 minus 2n, say the second one must be different from the first one, and so on until to k minus 1. And then you can approximate that and get this exponential, just in the limit of a large population, say as long as k is much smaller than n. So this explains why you have this decay with a characteristic k times k minus 1. So the effects of drift is to reduce the variability of the population, reduce the number of alleles which are present. And then out of that, I think I can stop here. So far, we have seen what happens in the absence of selection. And if we put in selection, say, I still have two alleles, but now the ratio of their fitness is, say, e to the s. So it's a small positive or negative number, it doesn't really matter. And then you can solve this equation. And what you get is, again, this. The probability distribution of having x different from 0 and 1 decays with these characteristic times, and the smallest eigenvalue as a function of s can be evaluated. And the frequency distribution is interesting to read. So in this case, we have frequency distribution for different values of s. You see that the quantity that is really important here is the product of s times the size of the population. So there is some sort of scaling law. We see them in a simpler form, but for the time being, just keep in mind that n times s is the relevant quantity. This is the neutral result, and then it goes down with a characteristic, exponent is t times t divided by 2n. This is that goes down in this way. And then for different values of this product n, s. So this is moderate selection, and s is equal to 1. In this case, it goes like 1.39 divided by 2n t. And it is, of course, biased towards 1. It's positive s.
So we're just going here is the slowest mode of
this is the slowest mode. Okay. Yeah. So that instead of being flat, it is biased in this way. And then if you increase the selection, you have a very strong bias towards mathematics. And of course, you have a probability of fixation, which is now favored. So the probability of fixation is no more symmetric, and you can solve it very easily. This is the equation for the ultimate probability fixation. And so this is the solution. You see that n, this is effective population size, then s, this is the initial frequency of the gene. And this is the kind of result you have. And you see that there are, say, basically there are two limits, and we'll discuss now in a moment with the figure. When the selection factor is small, but not too small, then basically the fixation probability is given by this. So it's 4 times NES times X0. And when it's so small that even this factor is, so 4 NES is much smaller than 1, then you have this behavior with slightly different dependence on the initial condition. See, here you see that how we reach the neutral tipping problem. Let's see a moment how the fixation probability works. So I take fixed value of the selection factor, so equals to 10 minus 4, and now I look at the dependence of the ultimate fixation probability on the initial frequency, going from 0 to 1. Of course, that means that also the fixation probability goes from 0 to 1. Now, these are 10 to the 5, 10 to the 4, 10 to the 3 population size. And this straight line is the neutral result. And what you see is that even for 10 to the 3, which means that the product NES is equal to 0.1, there is some selection effect. It's quite far from that. But of course, this is unfair. Why it is unfair? Imagine that we are looking at the probability of fixation of that advantageous mutant. A mutant arises, say, once in the population. So that means that its initial frequency is equal to 1 over 2n in the deployed population. So what we have to compare is what happens when the initial frequency is equal to 1 to 2n. And this is the second plot. So I take this equal, this is the initial frequency, this is the selection factor, and here we have so this is the neutral result, and here in this case we have 1,000 and 2,000 as a size of the population, so that this is a smaller population, this is a larger population, this is the neutral result, and this is a line in which the fixation probability is equal to 2s. And what you see is that as soon as n times s is of order 1, which is here, for instance, for the larger population, then we end up on this line. So the fixation probability in this case depends only on the, on the selective advantage. But if the selective advantage is small, then the fixation probability is small. That means that there must be many attempts before you fix one advantage is mutant in the population, because it's lost.
So is this assuming n equals n e, or is this keeping n and n?
Oh, this is n equals n e. And this the only quantity with the actually in, if you have different values of n e and n, what you have is a situation. This level here is 1 over 2n effective. The real census population, whereas the quantity which appears in the formula for the fixation probability is n e. But say this result, so in this case, instead of having 2s, you would have a 2s times n e divided by n, which can be even smaller.
So it's a scaling factor, it just scales everything down?
It's scaled differently here and the slope.
Okay, what is the philosophy behind such a small s, 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 3? Naively, I would expect that almost any mutation, it gives much more either advantage or disadvantage.
Disadvantage is what?
I would say 10%.
Well, if it is 10%, then you have a large probability of
just. Well, you can.
But then they would be very.
Well, why you choose the small?
Well, let's say this is probably a sort of a remainder of a gradualistic attitude. What you expect is that there are not major innovations in everyday evolution, and they only give a slight advantage.
All innovations are major because.
But most of these are not observable in these. You cannot tell genes, and it doesn't matter.
No, I mean, you can have a slide in any real life population. I doubt if the replacement will happen after 1,000 generations. Usually, it happens much faster.
Okay, but there are different problems at what time. How long does it take to get it to fixate, and how often it arises? And my guess is that a major advantageous mutations arise pretty rarely. And most of the times, if there are any advantageous mutations, they give only slight advantage.
Well, if you take a look at the weather, just fluctuations in the weather, fitness wise, I think are 20%. Because 1 year.
Weather.
1 year give advantage to thermophile, another year give advantage to species who prefer cold. So there is a lot of external parameters.
You can say average it out.
I didn't talk about that, but of course you can take into account also fluctuating selection rates.
Yeah. Yes. But it doesn't mean fixation.
It leads to fixation.
To make a point that there are numbers like external conditions which should fluctuate much, much higher variability than this 0.1%. Usually, you should expect 10-50% fluctuation of something.
But it's a relative advantage of the genes of the alleles which are present in the population. And most of the time, you have something which is more, say, it works at a certain level, and you cannot just change it that much without breaking the whole machinery. So that I really don't see why I should expect it to have a very large changes in the system for one mutant arising in one particular gene.
There's also the issue of synonymous substitutions which don't change the protein and which may be nearly neutral, and then substitutions in non-coding regions. So there's a whole lot of substitutions. I mean, there's a whole lot of variability at the genetic level which may have very small selective effects.
Say, in natural population, you hardly ever see a mutation which gets fixed because of its clear advantage.
Is there any evidence in humans like that things, say, have been fixed?
No, there have been. What you have is fixation, for instance, of antibiotic resistance. Okay, but in that case, one of the things is that the mechanism is not really this mechanism, because there is a lot of lateral transport of these of the gene for antibiotic resistance by plasmids, for instance, and also by conjugation. Conjugation would enter in this mechanism, but plasmids do not.
But I mean, they have.
I would agree with you. I mean, this is a very strong event.
But they have adaptive changes in bird beaks that people have seen occurring in real time. But in terms of fluctuating the fitness and things like that, I mean, this sort of says I have a wild type, boom, I have a mutation that occurs, and it's either fixed or eliminated, and then boom, the next one occurs. And I could imagine that the probability of nothing else occurring before, no other mutations occurring before this the fixed or eliminated, it's not reasonable that these would be mixed up with all sorts of other things. Which I can imagine would add a lot of error to this S, that would be S plus or minus whatever is happening in the genome. I'm just wondering
what happens. Problems. One is that you have, in general, coexistence of several different alleles, and this is what I'm going to talk about next.
Right.
But still, in this approach, I assume that each allele has its own fitness.
Okay, but what I'm talking about is sort of other changes in the genome.
That's different genes, different loci.
Right.
Okay. And in that case, you say, how does the change in the of the allele in locus A have and the contemporary change of allele in locus B have an effect on the fitness of the individual? This is the interaction, and of course that's a very hard problem.
But even if in a completely additive model, it would seem that it would be sort of complicated in terms of that I may have a negative substitution at the same time that I'm in a genome where I had a very advantageous substitution.
Well, if you have a number of loci which is small, you have no linkage disequilibrium. That basically means that you pick up the alleles for different loci at random, and you have multiplicative fitness, then the processes of substitutions in different loci act independently, and you can use this approach. If you have a few loci and you have epistatic interaction, then you can still use the same approach, only that in mathematics becomes more complicated because you have to consider all possible combinations of your alleles in different
loci. But Richard, I think part of what you're getting at is what I was talking about when I was talking about the local effective population size. So if you're in a region with a certain amount of linkage and you've got a certain probability of having selective sweeps that are adjacent, and those are happening on a regular basis, that means that your effective population size is being reduced, and that means at that particular site, your selective effect has to be stronger in order for it to make a difference on whether it's fixed or not. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
So you're absolutely right, I think, in what you're getting.
Yeah, you have one effect, which is, imagine that you have one mutant allele which is strongly advantageous as a circulating, so that it gets fixed in the population. What means is that all the population, starting from that fixation, will be descendant of an ancestor which had that mutation, plus a number of other ones which were not specially selected. So what you have is that there's a great reduction of the overall variability of the population. Okay. This can be taken into account.
It's also interesting, you have an effect where, and when you have a selective sweep like that, and it's essentially the local genome is being dragged with that selective sweep, that's effectively the same as a rapidly growing population.
Hmm. Because everything else is maturing.
Right, so I mean you have...
Yeah, you can just forget about the ones which are... Yeah, I just mentioned one effect on for the effective population size, and that is what you have if you have males and females, the effect, you can evaluate the effective population size as given by this formula by Sue Wright. And an interesting point here is that if you have just a few males mating and a large number of females, then these quantities of the order of basically the number of males. So in the case of the lek, you know, this birds of paradise in which you basically all females mate with a single male at each generation, then the effective population size is 4.
That's why it's called bird of paradise.
So for that male, it's paradise.
For the rest.
Now, substitution rate. Let's evaluate. Famous result, simple famous result. So just we remember that the fixation probability is equal to the initial frequency. And if you have a mutant which arises in the population, its initial probability is equal to 1 divided to n. And of course, that means that the fixation probability, okay, So it, what you have is that the rate at which it is produced is equal to the total population times the mutation rate. So you just get this, you put in the number of mutants which are produced at each generation, you find that the substitution rate is equal to the mutation rate. Say, you can qualify this by taking the distinction between effective and the census population. In this case, you have, this is even reduced. So that what you get is that the, on the other hand, for the case of advantageous mutants, what you have is this formula that we obtain by substituting the result we had before.
Now those rates that we heard the last 2 weeks that's used in phylogenetics.
These are
substitution rates.
The mutation rate we had a discussion about 3 weeks ago. Of the mutation rate. Petrov.
Okay, so then you're saying we should not be using Petrov kind of rates in the phylogeny.
Yeah,
we
should.
But that's the problem is when you've got, if you've got a pseudogene, you're a lot closer to the top line, and if you've got a protein, you've got some mixed model, a mixture between the two, and if you're ignoring the difference between whether it's selected or not, what's the best thing to do? That's a good question.
But the most useful distinction is between the neutral ones and the disadvantageous ones, usually imagining that you're evolving in a gene is evolving and it's already a pretty good gene, so the most changes are going to be disadvantageous, and most of those disadvantageous ones are going to be removed. So the substitution rate that you're going to see is the ones which are nearly neutral and which get through, so some fraction of those are going to be nearly neutral, and those are the ones that are going to accumulate in.
Yeah, so that means that here you would have a factor which is the probability that a mutant is not, say, terribly reflex.
A counterexample of that is yesterday's talk by Wilbur Fitch, which is, how long is this, not that?
Okay, so this is the other one. Point is how much genetic variability there is in a population. Just how to say how one tackle this problem by considering k alleles, say for a given gene, and then assume that there is a mutation rate which changes one into another with a probability, say AI goes into AJ with a probability U divided by k minus 1 per gene per generation, so on and so forth. And then you just plug in into the Fokker-Planck equation, and assuming detailed balance at equilibrium, what you get is a probability of equilibrium of this kind. You see that. So the parameter here is the effective population times the mutation rate, and there is okay. Small technical point, there is a divergence, small axis. So out of that, you can evaluate what is the average frequency of each allele at equilibrium. Okay, it's 1 over k, there's not much. I'm just supposing that the number of alleles is quite large. This is not very important. And the if you ask what is the effective number of alleles in the population, the effective number is something, is the inverse of the, we call it a participation ratio thinking in physics. So it's this, sum over the average square values of the frequency, 1 over. And so the effective number will be given by this expression.
Because the divergence is just due to the fact that there is fixation or more?
The divergence, yeah, it's related to the fact that to solve, yeah, since you are using sort of detailed balance, then you are conserving the total. So this is, this divergence here is telling you that you have not considered properly the boundary conditions.
I mean, I'm just trying to reconcile this with, you know, the fact that you tend to, Van der Kolk's evolution tends to consolidate genetic variability.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not in this model.
No, evolution does not consolidate. Group tends to kill genetic variability.
Right, but this is sort of saying that equilibrium.
So that you have a balance between the fact that all the time you're losing alleles because of your reason. And all the times you are remaking them out of mutation, so you reach some sort of equilibrium from zero. And this is the kind of equilibrium you're getting at. So this is effective number of alleles is given by that in the limit of large K. And the average number of alleles present in the population is given by K times the probability that, that you have lost some of the, that you have lost one given allele. So you take a distribution, the frequency distribution of that allele, and then you consider what is the probability that this allele is present, and you multiply that by the total number of alleles. And here, that's the point, and because of that divergence in near x, so what you have to do is say that whenever the frequency is smaller than 1 over 2n, you say that the allele has disappeared. So you get this expression, and this expression depends on the actual census population size, whereas the effective number of alleles only depends on the effective population size. So this is the number of alleles, this is the effective number of alleles as a function of the effective population size times the mutation rate, and these are the curves which correspond to the different population census population size, the true ones. So in this case, we have a result in which we can disentangle the dependence of the effective and the census population. And this is one of the predictions that I used to, say, give sense to the effective population size. Because this is observable in principle by using, say, sampling, and then you can reconstruct the effective population size.
And you're assuming equilibrium.
Assuming equilibrium, which is a terrible thing. Yeah. So yeah, there is this caveat, which is terrible, the fact that equilibrium is reached in a number of generations essentially proportional to population size. And so that means that equilibrium is out of the question. Okay. Yeah.
Assume this model. Now, finally, you're dealing with something which you can measure in real life. You make a snapshot of population, measure how many different alleles there are, and what is the, you couldn't measure effective population size, but you can measure the N capital.
Mm-hmm.
Can you now construct some kind of dimensionless combination of those two numbers to say something about your fitness difference or something, you know?
Yeah, this is purely neutral. Mm-hmm. You can generalize with a little bit. Yeah.
The thing which is related to this, which is very similar to that equation, is heterozygosity and homozygosity, right? So the sum of the x squared is the homozygosity, that's the probability of picking two alleles the same.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's something which is easy to measure experimentally. So people look at, they measure homozygosities in lots of different loci and ask whether or not this is a vary. So that's a way of estimating NEU, and it's also a way of checking for neutral theory, because you can ask whether the distribution of the homozygosities is what you'd expect it to be.
That in particular doesn't discriminate between N and NE. That's just checking whether you're matching.
No, you need at least two things.
No, it doesn't discriminate between N and U either. It gives you, it's a way of measuring the product of NE times U.
Mm-hmm. And then you have, and then you sense which are the different alleles. You get that. You get an estimate. Using the tool, you have some sort of.
It's also worth pointing out in this graph that those are extremely difficult things to measure. I mean, when you say, well, now we can compare, give sense to NE and N, and you have to remember that A, mutation rate is hard to measure, and you're talking about a situation where you need a bunch of different populations of a bunch of different species to compare between them, and also the census population size is not such an easy thing to measure. A, just flat out, it's a difficult thing to measure, and B, what we're actually talking about is the effect of reproducing population, the census reproducing population size, which you've actually got still no idea about. So there's, I mean, experimentally,
you still put an order of magnitude on each of those numbers. And if you further assume that NE is approximately equal to N, you can, I guess, estimate U, your small emissions, mutation rate.
Question. So NE, I think of it as sort of a fudge factor. You know, we want these equations to work out. It doesn't work out with N, so we'll use NE. In that case, why would we be interested in the exact value of NE? What is the significance of this?
No, what you get, in fact, is a, say, NEU,
yeah.
And then what you say, if you have a reasonable estimate for NE, then you get some ideas about the U, which is really what you want to get at.
Or vice versa. No, but you want to know something about the biology of the population, whether or not, for example, it's a bird of paradise case, or whether or not it's been through a bottleneck in the past, whether or not, you know, the amount of diversity that you see is much less than you would expect it to be given the present population size. That would tell you something about the history of the population. You know, and then you can also compare population from location, different locations, and ask whether or not the migration between the populations, you know, all that sort of thing.
I mean, that graph I sort of poorly tried to reproduce was the relationship between census population sizes and theory, whether with selection or without selection. And I mean, you could see, sort of, I was trying to get the idea across that the correspondence is extremely poor, so there's a lot of factors that are clearly.
What's the estimate of NE for E. coli? Capital N.
Well, it's E. coli a population. I think that Richard's comments are sort of I really dislike those studies that consider E. coli to be a population. That's just it's such a horribly meaningless thing. I mean, the difference is between different, you know, quote, E. coli, or I forget whether it's 10 or 100 million years. I mean, you're talking about non-recombining. You know, this is not a sexual.
Fine, but if I want to apply this study to E. coli, what should I do?
Something else.
I mean, at some point, well, there should be some, predictions, and then we'll go on to measure, and then see, right? With the Fox Alliance, it's kind of hard to do. But.
Yeah, say if you're really looking at the say bacterial and so on, then you have a problem that the populations are rapidly expanding, and then you don't know much or how much they interact in the mind. So probably in this case, it's really you are very far from the situation.
So you wouldn't want to apply this
study. In the wild, if you look at populations which are well defined, so on, then you probably can get. So if you look at the amount of molecular variability, molecular level of eukaryotic, well defined eukaryotic species in a well defined geographic area. Yeast is in some sense the same sort of problem that economics has, and even if it is sexual, because you have
strains are associated with separate from
laboratory strains, yeah.
But it doesn't matter whether there's sexual transmission or not, does it, as long as you have a mixed population?
At this level, yeah, there is nothing special about a level of oneness.
So we have a problem where you would like to apply this to something with a fixed population size like a fox and so forth, but then
you would like to have, although as I said before, you never reach equilibrium, you would like to have something, some process which is sort of more or less uniform.
And I'm not so stupid on insects. Because in insects you can breed and you can measure these things as well. So they're sort of nice intermediate things. Yeah.
But if I imagine I have a very rapidly exploding population, and I consider a subset of the population a fixed size as long as my subset is drawn from my previous subset, then all these theories would work fine, right?
The coefficient probabilities are very different from the expanding population.
It's different.
But I don't
think... You won't lose, I mean, one principle, in a growing population, you just won't lose alleles.
Yeah, but if I say that I ignore everything that that falls outside my subset, so every time I have a gigantic sample, and I just take 10,000 of them and use that, then I have gigantic sample of the next generation, but I only take 10,000 of that, and then I keep artificially just neglecting everything that is constant.
You're saying your sample?
No, because what you have to get your second sample is sampled out of the descendants of the first sample.
Right, as long as that condition is. So the fact that there's E. coli in Asia doesn't affect what I observe in a fixed location here, as long as they're not.
But then you're essentially like putting species barriers between the subpopulation and the rest, and that sort of then you have reduced the problem to a small population.
I mean, the point with the E. coli is that from sampling E. coli, treating samples of E. coli populations from the wild so that are confined population, I would consider an extremely dubious thing. Now, treating growing E. coli in a chemostat and looking at substitutions and things is a reasonable thing.
Look, I'm trying to pretend I'm an experimentalist, and I just want to know two things. One is, like, what's the ideal case for the application? Is there some thing that it can apply to, and then that they want to go on and do some measurement and then follow the indications?
I mean, there is this
work. And the other is for easily manipulable objects, so like E. coli yeast. Are there some theory that would tell me about the evolution of these?
There are these estimates of minimal population sizes, say lions in a national park. There this is quite a good approximation that they don't mix with other lions. And then, so you have all these estimates. So there is a minimum population that's viable, and that's probably maybe.
I know that there have some studies of Drosophila in the wild, actually, in Southern California. And in that case, you have a reasonable population size, a fast, say short generation time, and the population have been separated for quite a long time, so that you are not terribly far from this.
Work.
And these are, in fact, the things that
work. So these have been applied to the process?
I mean, you can find papers with tables of NE measured in lots of different species, and it tends to be...
But that in itself doesn't tell me that much. I mean, if we treat it as an effective parameter, so what? But then, given that NE, there should be something else, and there should be comparative theory, and then there's something else.
Say, for instance, you get...
Yeah, there's lots of people do things like that.
One example is, for a long time, people were trying to do this kind of thing with allozymes. Okay, these are observed protein variants. These are usually metabolic proteins, and are looking at amino acid variants and measuring how they change in a gel, right? So they're distinguishing variants in that way. People tried to measure all these things, assuming they were neutral, and did these for a long time. Then people started doing DNA sequencing on things that were much more plausibly neutral alleles and getting very different answers about NE and things like that, and that tends to make you think
that these are things that are behaving in very different ways, and therefore maybe there's more neutrality at one and more selection at the other, that kind of thing. And that was also originally in Flies.
Okay, so just this is a summary of, say, these are the kind of a sketch of the substitution process. So most, you have variant, let's say mutants arising all the time, but most of them, they were simply weeded out by drift of them. And then from time to time, one gets to fixation. Typical time needed to get to fixation by neutral drift is of the order of 4 and E. On the other hand, the time between this different fixation is independent of n, of population size, and is equal to the inverse of the mutation rate. And the reason why, so the population size disappears is that if you have larger population, it takes longer time to get fixed, but the also the probability that the mutant arises increases in the same way, so that in at the end you get the same substitution rate.
I don't understand. If you had non-sexual reproduction, then if I had another mutation that occurred, it would either be on a member. In other words, what I'm wondering is, it would seem that that once I have fixation. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we go back to the first transparency and say, now we can say that, say, substitution rate is, well, they say it's less than or equal mutation rate because, of course, there is this factor that is the probability that the mutation is not selected against. So you have this very large mutation rate, large substitution rate, unless the fitness variation is small, and so the bottom line is that most substitutions should be for neutral or maybe slightly deleterious mutants.
Within
we already say the starting point of the neutral theory.
Within this sort of space of slightly deleterious, and there should also be a crossover then, sort of from the ones that are sort of still close to neutral in your sense and the ones that are.
Yeah, the factor is a 4NES. So as soon as 4NES becomes appreciable, then it is not slightly deleterious. Absolutely not. Yes.
So the crossover scale is population size.
Yeah, scale is population size
dependent. So
yeah.
That would mean that the law that the substitution rate is close to the bare mutation rate, that would be broken at a population size dependent scale. Is that?
Well, there is this factor. So the factor is what is the probability that the mutation which arises is selected against. This is a factor which is of order one, but is smaller than that. So it is, in any case, it's very close.
But by that factor, you're lumping together all the ones that are followed of the other side of your crossover. Yeah. But that crossover scale is itself population size dependent.
Yeah, but it's what I say is that it's just very slowly varying. Because you are close to the value S, close to zero, as of S of order one over n. So it doesn't change much as long as the. What you expect is that the probability that you get any value of S is independent of population size. So the only thing you have, so it will be some sort of probability distribution. So the only have variation of the order of one over n for this probability. And you have 1 minus something of order 1 over n as a correction factor there.
So does anybody after listening to this believe in a molecular clock?
So let's thank David and Luca.